Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of Nerdy Notions with Sasha Kaplan.
Hello, everybody. I'm Sasha Kaplan, and I'm very excited to talk about this week's film, which is, of course, if anybody tuned in last week where we talked about Thor Dark World, you would know. Thor Ragnarok, thank you.
You were back about like 15 movies on that one. It's like,
I really did. I don't know why. But anyway, so if you watched Thor Ragnarok episode, there we go. All of our negative 54 listeners would know by now that today we are talking about Black Panther. And there's, of course, a certain irony here of two Jews talking about Black Panther because, of course, Black Panther was created by two Jews. So, if you don't know who Jack Kirby is at this point, why are you watching the show? Go back and like go do some research. Bye.
But not only that, but we were just talking about this before we hit the record button so people can listen to us. They can't watch us, they're listening to us. We can see each other. Put that tongue away, young lady. But but the interesting thing is that like we were talking about this before we started recording, is that you know, the timing of this episode is also, you know, weirdly rightly timed at the same time about what's going on in the country right now, because, you know, there's such turmoil going on in the country and there's this march for change, you know, because, and let's be honest, you know, yes, we have the people chanting out all lives matter. Yes, all lives do matter, but they won't truly matter until Black Lives Matter, because of the injustices that have been put towards them in the centuries that this country has been here. So it's actually really great to actually be doing Black Panther during this time for us.
Especially because some of the topics that we are rediscussing right now as a country are also some of the questions that are brought up in the film as well. So this will be a very interestingly and unintentionally timed episode of Black Panther.
Yeah, but it's in all irony, things happen for a reason, and I'm kind of glad that happened this way.
If it was meant to be, it was meant to be. So yep. With that, we're going back to a very ancient time, 1992.
Oh, God.
A time before Power Rangers. Dramatic pause. A time when 80s music was still listened to in public. A time when, nope, that's it. Anyway.
a time when you weren't alive?
This is true. And
I was maybe turning 6 years old.
You know how old I am. You can carbon date me by Power Rangers. We had this conversation.
This is very true. It's sad now that I can only use the two 30-year-olds talking about the kid show Power Rangers when I record with Brian or Ed. I can't use it with anyone else.
Yep. Anyway, but actually, before we go back to 1992, we start the film with a young boy asking his father to tell him the story again. And so we hear what is King T'Chaka's voice talking about kind of how Wakanda came to be, how this meteor crash landed in this part of Africa, and how it changed the landscape, and how there were these five tribes that came, that existed on this land, and how basically they were fighting until one received a vision from the goddess Bast, through a special herb, which gave him powers, and he became the first Black Panther. He then kind of united the tribes. Four tribes joined under the Panther rule, and the Jabari tribe did not, and kind of left to the mountains. So vibranium is the source of the technological advancement and power that is Wakanda. It is the thing in Captain America's shield. It's really cool. That's all I gotta say right here. So that is the source of Wakanda's tech. And because it's so powerful, because it's such an amazing
metal resource,
thank you, that's the word I was looking for, element. And all of the stuff that was going on around Wakanda, the people of Wakanda decided to keep the country hidden and isolated, despite everything that was going on the continent itself. You see, like, the slave trade and various wars that are happening in Africa, and you see Wakanda very isolated. The visuals for how this story is told is also very, very cool and kind of like a sand way. It's very, very beautiful.
It's done in a very tribal way. I think that's probably the right way to put it.
Well, it uses, well, that too, but like it uses sand to tell the story.
Yeah.
So now we go to Oakland, California, 1992, where we see kids playing a game of basketball. And we see this like really, we see this building. On the television are the LA riots, actually. And you see two men who are kind of coming up with a plan to get weapons to some other men. And there's a knock on the door. And one guy tells the other guy to go, you know, go and check it out. And he's like, oh, there's a bunch of women at the door. He's like, oh, you should probably let them in because they won't knock twice. And the Dora Milaje come in. Did I mispronounce that? It's entirely possible. Nope, I did not. Okay. So the Dora Milaje, for those that are interested in the comics, they are a very strong group of women warriors. They protect the king. And what's actually really cool is in the comics, each tribe tends to send its strongest females to become Dora Milaje. So it's a very high honor, and they're just badass. They really are. Like, anytime they're on screen anywhere, in the last film, we saw them very briefly. Civil War. That's technically the last time we saw anything related to Wakanda in context. You see them a little bit, especially in a deleted scene, and they're just come off as like this force to be reckoned with. Like, you don't want to piss them off. You really don't. So the two women enter and they want proof that he is who he says he is. And so one of the guys pulls, the main person who's like leading the plans, pulls like his lip down, and on the inside there's like a tattoo of like, I guess, Wakandan writing. And then the lights go out.
Well, no, they pound their staffs, and then the lights go out. They pound their staffs again, the lights come on, and then there's King T'Chaka.
A much younger King T'Chaka, and he's here to greet his younger brother. And so he tells them about a man named Ulysses Klaue.
It's Ulysses Klaue.
I'm calling him Klaue, and that's all that's going to happen. So Klaue stole vibranium from inside Wakanda, and then he detonated a bomb. And basically, the king believes that this was an inside job. Because, like, how else was he going to know about Wakanda and vibranium and whatnot? So T'Chaka knows that his brother, Prince N'Jobu, is basically the one who did it and helped Klaue to do that. But it is also revealed that the man sitting next to the prince is a guy named Zuri. He's also from Wakanda, and he was set there by King T'Chaka to spy on him. And basically the plan is to like bring N'Jobu back to Wakanda to face trial. And he gives a little speech about like how Wakanda's responsibility is to help others and how this is bullshit and how he didn't do anything wrong. And basically T'Chaka ends up killing N'Jobu and they leave. And
well, it's implied.
It's implied. Well, yeah. He does kill
him. No, he does. But the thing is though, is that at that time, it's implied. We don't actually see the murder until much later. We don't see the murder until actually later in the film.
So we're going to flash forward to the present, or actually slightly in the past, because the present. This is a week after the events of Civil War. They actually state that, which is very nice. So we see there's a screen and there's like a television report going on inside a ship about how the entire nation of Wakanda is mourning the loss of its King T'Chaka. And that, like, we hear this, like, Wakanda is described as like a third world nation that doesn't accept foreign aid and all this jazz. So they are sort of on their way back to Wakanda, but they're doing a stop in Nigeria. So I'm going to pause here for a second because this is what I find really interesting. We, over the course of, like, Wakanda is essentially an isolated nation that, by T'Chaka's words, even like in the flashback, he's like committed to keeping Wakanda isolated. Nobody knows like that Wakanda is not a third world nation or anything like that. So it kind of makes King T'Chaka's like support for the Sokovia Accords and everything like a little iffy to me, because like I get he wants the world to keep things at bay. I don't know. Maybe I think it adds a nice layer of complexity to the king. So even if I don't agree with him.
Well, and you bring up the complexity of the king as we get a little further on, because one of the things that in that opening sequence did was give the origins of the Black Panther.
Which is very important.
Which is very important. And also they did it in a way where they don't spend the majority of the movie doing an origins, essentially. Because we've already met T'Challa in Civil War. So we've already been introduced. We now got the origins of how Black Panther came about. And
how Wakanda came about.
And how Wakanda came about. Now we're actually going to get to see the rituals of how. Yep. But before we get there, they do the stop in Nigeria because they need to go pick somebody up.
So what's really cool here is that we see a little bit more of the tech of Wakanda, this cool spaceship, how they're able to follow the traffic of the convoy that they're going to be stopping through, like this like sand tech thing. That's really cool.
It's almost like Stark tech. Like, you know how Tony Stark will pull up?
Yes, but Tony's is projection based. This is like literally inside the sand, it looks cool. That's the most important thing. It just looks cool.
It's a different variation of the projections.
Yeah.
Let's put it in perspective like that. It's just like the way Tony Stark's projections are done, but in a different different method.
Anyway, so Okoye wants to go and drop down with T'Challa, but he says no, he can handle it, and she tells him not to freeze. So they are going to get Nakia, we'll get to her in a second. So they stop the convoy, with these like tech things that like make all of the, power down all the trucks and like disable them. And then T'Challa just like walks through all of these like very Boko Haram-esque mercenary people. And we see that there's a moment where they like come out to figure out what's going on. And we see that at the end of the convoy, there's a truck full of women. And we specifically see one woman played by the absolutely gorgeous Lupita Nyong'o. And she's like watching everything very suspiciously. So T'Challa walks through all of them and then this woman, who we later find out is Nakia, is also a very well-established fighter. But when T'Challa sees Nakia, he does in fact freeze. So Okoye ends up
making the save
and killing the last bad guy. And we actually see that one of the there's like one other soldier that T'Challa didn't get a chance to get to, who turns out to be a kid. And Nakia's like, no, he's also a prisoner. Or he's also been kidnapped. And so they save the women and they're like, okay, go back to your homes and make sure this boy gets back to his people and tell no one. I hope they made it back safe.
And also, this is the beginning of a recurring theme with T'Challa, where he gets made fun of.
Oh, he gets made fun of a lot in this movie.
But this is like the beginning of it, because it's like, he froze, didn't he? It's like, yeah, he did.
Well, hold on. Before we get there, it's important to note that Nakia doesn't understand what T'Challa's doing there. She's actually very angry at him for coming to what he thinks is a very nice rescue. Until he tells her, so she's very upset with him, like, this is her job, she's doing good, she can't just leave. And he tells her, Nakia, my father has died. So we return to the Wakanda. And it's really cool as the sun rises and we see, like, what is the, like, border tribe a little bit. And they're, like, on horseback. And then we see them fly towards the trees through this, like, shield-looking thing. And it's just, like, the bed of trees disappears. And all you see is, like, this very beautiful high-tech city of Wakanda. It's a really gorgeous visual. Let's see. So Okoye calls Nakia her sister, which is kind of interesting because she's not a Dora Milaje, strictly speaking. She's more of like a spy. But let's see. So as they arrive, they are greeted by technically T'Challa's stepmom, but I guess here she's just mom, which is, you know, doesn't really matter, but I think it's like, it doesn't change the relationship in my opinion in any way. And Angela Bassett is a queen.
Angela Bassett is amazing.
She's amazing. She's a fantastic actress, and she adds so many layers to the queen. And there's so much, like, I love this woman. She's just amazing. We also meet T'Challa's sister, played by Letitia Wright, who her name is Shuri. And so they, so as they're getting off the plane, they're like, oh, hello, brother, hello, mother, yada, yada, yada. Shuri asks, did he freeze? And Okoye goes, like an antelope in the headlights. We also find out that Okoye is not just a warrior. She is, in fact, a general. That is very important.
It should be noted that now that we've introduced Shuri, we need to note that, you know, Shuri is the one who does a lot of the joking on T'Challa.
I mean, and speaking as a sister, it's kind of in the job description.
But one of the greatest things, and there's a meme online about this. So, like, you could literally be at a very serious, like, meeting of, like, world leaders, and then you can introduce King T'Challa, nerd. You just hear Shuri in the background yelling out nerd. So
I believe it. And you know, as we go through this, I think anybody who hasn't seen this movie, first of all, how have you not seen this movie if you're watching or listening to this podcast? But seriously, anyway, so they are back to get things ready for the coronation, and we also find out that Nakia is from the River Tribe. So one of the other Doras is asked to escort Nakia to her people. So, and Shuri, meanwhile, takes T'Challa's tech. She's like, oh, I've developed an upgrade. And he's like, oh, but it's fine. It's like, well, just because it's fine doesn't mean it can't be better. And now we go to the British Museum in London. We go at the British Museum of Colonialist History. Well, so we see a man played by, I believe it's Michael B. Jordan, right?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Is asking this, like, very pasty, very slightly sickly looking curator lady about various artifacts. Like, oh, this is Ghana, 16th century. And, you know, and, like, she's, like, the expert on all of these different things. And so he kind of tests her a little bit. And then finally, they go to this, like, I guess it's, like, a little bit like an axe thing.
It's like a pickaxe hammer combo where you can hammer it with one end and you can axe, you know, like, pickaxe with the other end.
It's basically a pickaxe. And she's like, oh, this is from Benin, 7th century, I believe, or 6th century. And he's like, nope, wrong lady. It's from Wakanda. And he's like, but don't worry, I'm gonna take it off your hands. And she's like, excuse me? And she's like, you know, he makes a really great point about how, like, all of these, it's really funny how he basically tells her off, because he says, like, yeah, it was found in Benin, but, like, it's not actually from there. It's from Wakanda. And she's like, what? And there's a nice jab about the fact that, like, all of those artifacts were, like, you know, stolen and pillaged by the British.
Yep.
And so he's like, yeah, you should, we're, you know, you had cameras and security guards on me the second I walked in, but you should have been paying more attention to what you put in your body. So we know that the tea, or I'm going to guess it's tea because they're British, that it was poisoned. I just assume Brits don't drink coffee because they're lame. Kidding. But they are lame. No, just kidding. So the...
Yeah, you got to be careful. You're going to be doing an episode with Ben soon.
Oh, well, yeah, I can take him. I can take him. First of all, let the record show, this is the first I've heard of doing an episode with Ben, but that doesn't mean I'm opposed to it.
No, Power Dorks, Mighty Morphin Season 1 finale is when all four of us are together.
Well, that's still a ways away. Anyway, so the she ends up falling and, like, collapsing on the ground, and EMTs arrive, like, way too quickly for normal. And one of them, of course, is neither person is an EMT. We also see the woman at this, like, little coffee cart. She's like, oh, I'm going to take my break now, and she leaves. And she ends up, like, putting a loop on the security cameras. So the EMTs, one of the EMTs is actually one of the bad guys, who has been mentioned and seen once before, and that is Ulysses Claw. And he, like, decimates the guys, and he tells one guy, like, it's okay, you can go, don't worry about it. And as he's running, he shoots him. And and Michael B. Jordan's character is like, wait, why'd you do that? You could have just shot him right here. Like, oh, it spreads out the crime scene, makes us look like amateurs or something. And so he, for those that don't remember, Claw lost his arm way too many movies ago in Age of Ultron. He gets a cool high-techy arm. And it's like this cool, like, robotic hand that, like, opens up at the slit of the, like, palm. And I don't know why I'm showing you this, because it's not like anybody else can see it, but whatever. And there's, like, this, like, energy beam that flies out of it, like a vibration. And it destroys the glass case. And then it, like, vibrates. He vibrates it over the spear pickaxe thing. And, like, all of the dirt and grime and stuff just disappears to relive this, like, cool metal, which he, like, breaks off the stick part. It just keeps the metal part. And then we see that he sees this, like, cool and then Michael B. Jordan's character, who does not have a name yet. We don't actually know who he is yet. Just, like, takes this cool mask. He's like, oh, I dig it. I'm taking it. We know, if anybody forgot that Ulysses Claw is a jerk, don't worry. You'll be reminded. So it's coronation day, and T'Challa is about to be crowned king, but part of being crowned king is because of, like, how the tribes were unified, I guess, anytime a new king is crowned, or I guess in the comics, it was, like, once a year or something, there's, like, a special ceremony that anyone who thought they could do a better job than the king could challenge the king. Here, it's, like, during a coronation, I guess. And so it's basically ritual combat, and it's really cool how remember how we said that there's different tribes. So each of the tribes actually, they took different, inspirations from different parts of Africa in order to, add color to the country, but also show different types of people and culture. And to show the different tribes. So the border tribe was inspired by Lesotho people, so the architecture and language. And I guess, and I'm reading this off the IMDb. I've had a blast reading the IMDb page for this film. There's so much amazing information. The tribe symbol is the Lesotho word for horsemen. Their motif is blue, which is one of the Lesotho, which is a national Lesotho color. Is it Lesotho or Lesotho? Is that? So I apologize if I mispronounced that. The river tribe is inspired by the Surma and the Morsi people of Ethiopia. The Nilotic people who hail from the River Nile, their motif is green and shells. They wear crocodile skins and leather. You also have the mining tribe, which was inspired by the Himba and Maasai of Southern Africa, which is red and orange, and they have, like, a lion theme design. The merchant tribe is inspired by the, I'm gonna mispronounce this so badly, Tuareg of the Sahara, and they have kind of like a purple motif. And then you have the Jabari tribe, which we will get to in a second. Was inspired by the Bari, Igbo, and Dogon people of Western Africa, shamanistic naturalist tribes, which is fur and wood to honor their sacred animal, the gorilla. So I love the fact that, like, there's a lot of really good inspiration from the things around it. And it, like, if I remember correctly, the people that, like, were behind this film actually did a lot of research into Africa. They had a consultant on African history come in. Or cultural and history of Africa, which was really, really cool. So these different tribes basically are all given the chance to challenge, and all of the different tribes one by one say, we will not challenge today. And then the Jabari come in. And
real quick,
so,
I want to throw this out there real quick before you get to the Jabari tribe. So the director of this film is Ryan Coogler. And I hope I pronounced his last name correctly. Ryan actually also, by directing this film, also becomes the first Black director in the entire MCU. So, and if you actually watch the Blu-ray version of the film, he actually goes in depth about how he wanted to really bring the spirit of Africa into this film. And it shows. It really does.
It does.
So, back to the challenges.
Yes. So each tribe does not challenge. They seem to be pretty happy with T'Challa. He seems like a competent fellow. Like, it's all good. But part of it that I don't think is a thing in the comics, but I'm not as well versed on my Black Panther comics, about the, like, the flower and the liquid that gives him the Black Panther powers being stripped away and whatnot. So in this iteration in the film, the powers are stripped away and he basically has to fight as a mortal man for the right to become Black Panther and to be king. So then the Jabari come, and the Jabari live in the mountains, and they are very interested in, I guess, because they walked away, they didn't get all of the benefits of being part of Wakanda. So M'Baku, the leader of the Jabari tribe, comes to challenge him. And he's kind of like a funny jerk.
Well, his speech was amazing. Like, that speech he makes about why he's going to challenge is amazing, because he goes, we've been watching from the mountains and we're disgusted by your technological advances, which is headed by this little girl, pointing out Shuri, and
who doesn't respect, like, the traditions and, like, heritage. And, like, in her defense, she probably doesn't as much. But, or I guess not in her defense, she does kind of scoff at some of the traditions. But it's interesting how the traditions are. So, like, in other iterations of other comics, of other heroes, of other characters, of other, like, similar style stories, there's always a struggle between religion and technology. Where, like, the more technologically, like, advanced a person is, the more technology there is, the less religion there seems to be. And what I really love that they did here is there is a lot of spirituality and a lot of faith and a lot of trust in the ancestors, in Bast. And all of that is not in any way, nothing cancels out the other, so to speak. Everything works intertwined with each other. And I think that's really well done storytelling. So M'Baku does challenge. There's some really amazing fight choreography here, and M'Baku puts up a really good fight. When he, like, stabs T'Challa with the spear, I was like, oh god, wait a minute, this is only the beginning of the movie. So T'Challa ultimately wins, but the point is that you either win by getting the other person to yield or they're dead. So T'Challa tells M'Baku to yield and tells him that repeatedly because he doesn't want to kill him. And
and not only that, but the other thing is that the reason he doesn't want to kill him is because he understands how much M'Baku means to his tribe.
Exactly.
And if M'Baku falls at the hands of T'Challa, he knows that the Jabari tribe could fall into chaos as a result.
Exactly.
And he does not want that to happen.
And that's what ultimately, I think that's what ultimately puts M'Baku on the, okay, I should probably live. Because at one point, he actually tells T'Challa, like, just beat me, just kill me. And T'Challa tells him, no, that's not the point. I'm not going to do that.
Yep.
And so it should be noted that the guy who ends up stripping Black Panther of his powers here is played by Forrest Whitaker. This is Zuri. This is the guy who was friends with, who was sent by King T'Chaka to spy on his brother.
But we don't know that yet.
We don't know this yet. We just know it's the same guy. Well, actually, we do know this because his name is Zuri. We know it's the same guy. But anyway, so let's see. So after the fight, there's this, they're in this like spiritual room where he's given his he drinks the juice of the flower or whatever, and he is gonna go to the ancestral plane where I guess the panther god will decide if he's cool enough to be king or whatnot. And there's a reason I bring this up. And then he gets buried under this pile of red sand, and it was all very well done. And we see these kinds of like flashbacks of him as a child, the explosion that killed his father. And he arrives on this very purplish looking, like, you know, savanna plane. And with panthers, there's like three panthers on this tree, and one of them like drops down and it like is his, and that ends up being T'Chaka. And it's very beautiful. It's like a beautiful reunion of like, oh, you know, seeing your father. And T'Challa isn't sure if he is like ready. And T'Chaka offers him some words of wisdom. And, you know, but I think the point is that T'Challa is, you know, he has doubts, but he wants to be a good king. And so he wakes up and he is healed. We then go to a very vibrant market in Wakanda, which is like, I guess, slightly more on the outskirts as opposed to like the main part of the city with all of the cool tall buildings. And he's asking Nakia to stay. She says that she doesn't really want to stay, that she's helping people, and that Wakanda can do more, like aid, help refugees, and that they could do it better than other countries do it. And honestly, it's really not that hard to do it better than what's been going on right now. But the share, so she's talking about like taking in refugees, the sharing of technology, etc. And T'Challa is kind of reluctant, and he's not sure if that's, he believes that Wakanda can, and Nakia basically tells him that Wakanda can protect itself and also help others. And Nakia's like, he tells her like, you're really, like, if you weren't so stubborn, you'd make a great queen. And she's like, well, it's because I'm stubborn that I would make a great queen if that is what I want. It doesn't sound like that's what she wants. So it definitely sounds like she's definitely committed to the past, to doing what she's been doing, which is being out there on the front lines, helping people. Let's see. So T'Challa goes to see his friend who is one of the border tribe whose name was, I have it written down here somewhere.
Wakabi.
Wakabi, thank you. So Wakabi is like, oh yeah, this is a good, like, he's talking about like cleaning up the world, quote unquote, and like, but not letting anybody else in. And T'Challa kind of like assumes he's talking about like waging war. Like, cleaning up the world is a big, big statement to make. That could mean a lot of things. So Okoye they both get called in to go back to like the throne room or whatever where the council's assembled, and they found Claw basically, and that 30 years ago, we get kind of like the rehash of what happened, that like 30 years ago he stole a whole bunch of vibranium from Wakanda, and we learned that he killed Wakabi's parents and that he wants revenge. He basically tells T'Challa that like you either need to kill him or bring him back to like either kill him or like bring him back to base's crime so I can kill him. And T'Challa says he's gonna bring him back alive. So we also see that Shuri is kind of running the lab in the catacombs of Wakanda, And she has developed some new tech based on Back to the Future, like, sci-fi technology. And of these, like, super sound-absorbing shoes, and she calls them sneakers. Get it?
Hardy har har har. Har har har.
So she's also developed a couple of new suits. And it's so funny how she's like, okay, you need to kick it. It's like, see, the kinetic energy is absorbed. And then she, like, pulls her device out to, like, record the thing.
Well, no,
like,
no. First, he kicks it, and she gets offended by how hard she kicks it.
Yep.
And then she shows off the kinetic energy.
Well, not yet. She tells him about the kinetic energy. And then she's like, okay, kick it again. And then she starts recording. He's like, why are you recording this? This is for research purposes. And so he kicks it again in the same spot, and he just gets tossed back. He's like, delete that footage. Which was also a meme, I think, at one point. Let's see. So they go to Korea to get to Claw, and they end up in this, like, Okoye has a really awful wig on, and she hates it, and I hate it too.
I think everyone can mutually agree. We all hate that wig.
We all really hated that wig. So they go into this, like, illegal, very illegal-looking underground nightclub. And we see that they go through these metal detectors, and it's very interesting that the metal detectors don't go off, even though they're all wearing technically a ton of metal. So what this means is that vibranium is a different kind of metal than what we think of. Therefore, the metal detectors are not able to detect it because they're only calibrated for so much. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of Americans, and we see a very familiar American. It's General Ross. No, just kidding. It's Agent Ross, the slightly not a jerk Ross. The significantly less of a jerk Ross. The passable human we kind of like him Ross. Look, there's only so many Rosses we can like. It's like one per decade. So Everett is played by Martin Freeman, and in case you forgot, he works for the CIA. And I guess the Americans are here to make a deal with Claw to trade diamonds for some vibranium or something like that.
Yeah, they're trading the diamonds for the vibranium that was stolen from the British Museum.
Right, there you go. So, but they're also after Claw, so everybody's after him, basically. And there's the Stan Lee cameo.
Which is hilarious because T'Challa wins and just walks away before he's told that he won.
Yeah, and Stan Lee's like, I'm just gonna hold on to these.
Right over here, because I don't trust.
He's stealing chips just like he stole credit from other people.
But the funny thing is that he doesn't trust Agent Ross with T'Challa's chips.
I wouldn't trust anybody with the last name Ross, so I can't really blame him. Even though he did kind of clean up, like, it is acknowledged that, like, T'Challa had handed over Zemo to Ross, and Ross kind of made the whole Black Panther thing kind of go hushy hush. Claw arrives, he sets off the metal detectors, but no one cares. Okoye ends up creating a distraction because Nakia's about to go and she's like, don't do it! And then she's up creating a distraction. She's a bad, every person in this movie is a badass, okay? Like, everyone. The queen is too beautiful to be referred to as a badass, but she's a badass in her own right anyway. So Claw really owes Ultron for dropping, you know, for killing his arm because he got a pretty badass arm out of it. So Nakia and Okoye go after him, and Shuri ends up taking over another vehicle and, like, virtually piloting it, which is really cool. The new suit can rip cars apart because of, like, the absorption of the kinetic energy, and he just has, like, increased strength as Black Panther. It's a lot of cool stuff going on. The all of the details of, like, the car chases are pretty cool. Let's see. Okoye's spear. So Okoye grabs her spear and she, like, just throws it. It rips through the car that Claw is in, and then it stops the car. Like, they crash into it, which is really funny. But then Claw little arm bomb thing, pulsar ray gun, like, destroys the car. It was a very nice car. That made me sad. And then you see, like, Nakia just, like, in a seat holding the steering wheel. But ultimately, Claw is captured, but before T'Challa can kill him, Ross is there, and he's like, get in, we'll take it from here, like, come with me, because the world is watching. So Ross offers them a lift, and we learned that, you know, in case you didn't know, Claw's a racist. I'm so shocked. Like, really, I did not expect that. Anyway, so he's taken into custody. He's also insane. It's kind of funny watching him in the chair because he's handcuffed with his good arm. And in the, I guess, the other hand, even though there's, like, nothing, like, there's nothing there, it's, like, duct taped to his body. It's too funny. So there's, like, a little bit of a debate of who gets to talk to Claw first. And Ross is like, I'll go. Like, should we bad guy, bad cop, good cop this? Like, how do you want to handle it? And Okoye's like, we can't let him talk to him. Like, oh, we'll give him 5 minutes. It's fine. And so Ross goes in to talk to him. And
but while all this is going on, T'Challa puts a little microphone on Ross so that him and Okoye can actually listen in.
Indeed. So, Chloe tells him that, like, his cannon arm thing is, like, not even the tip of the iceberg. It's, like, a speck of snow on the iceberg of Wakanda weapons. And he tells him that, like, basically Ross doesn't believe Claw when he tells him that, like, Wakanda is, like, a advanced technological miracle magic country. And he's like, no, Wakanda's a third world country. And Claw just laughs at him. To be honest, having interacted with T'Challa and Okoye and Nakia at this point, how can you possibly think that? He has a, like, first of all, like, even just, like, going off Black Panther himself, T'Challa, he has a freaking advanced suit that makes Tony Stark's armor look like a tin can, which it is, but that's not the point. Like, that would have cost money, time, effort. Like, that had to come from somewhere. Or did Everett decide, not my problem? We also, by the way, learned that Everett was an Air Force pilot. That's important for later. But anyway, so Wakanda is basically El Dorado. Technological marvel, blah, 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 blah. Ross doesn't believe him. We see the girl from the museum, the one that was, like, handing the poisonous tea to the British lady. Ross tells T'Challa that Claw is lying, and there's, like, an explosion which rips the wall away from the where Claw's being held. And Ross actually, like, throws himself in front of Nakia and saves her as she, like, walks into the room to warn them that something's gonna happen. But T'Challa goes after Claw, and Claw gets away because somebody else that has a interesting gold necklace with, like, a ring on it, like, fights him up, and, basically Claw gets away, and they take Everett to Wakanda to heal him.
Yeah, because Everett got shot.
He got shot in the spine. But, I gotta say, that's some, like, impressive persuasion skills, because, like, there's, like, closer hospitals, and if, I guess I'm poking a little bit at the logic here, like, everyone assumes that Wakanda is a third world country, right?
Yep.
So you're just gonna let the king of said third world country take this guy who's potentially dying and may never walk again to Wakanda to be treated. I mean, maybe they told them they had somebody who could do it, but I don't know, that's, like, if you don't know Wakanda is a technologically advanced, and I guess medically advanced Marvel, like, why would you just let them go? But I'm nitpicking at this point, so I'll let it go. So, Okoye is not amused at the notion of taking Everett to Wakanda, but they do it anyway. And as he arrives, Shuri says, oh, good, you brought me another white boy to for us to fix, which is a reference to Bucky. I'm sure we won't see him in this. So Wakabi comes to see about Claw, but T'Challa tells him that he got away, and we see that vengeful look in his eye. Meanwhile, Claw is going to a plane-ish looking junkyard, like there's planes there. And Michael B. Jordan's character, whose name is Eric, he wants Claw to take him to Wakanda, and Claw doesn't, he's like, ha ha, that's funny. But Claw ends up being killed because he's a jerk and a racist, and yeah. Michael B. Jordan's character is revealed to be Wakandan. Meanwhile, T'Challa starts asking questions because of the ring and because he saw the ring and about his uncle in Jabu, and Zuri tells him what happened. Even though it should be noted that Zuri's kind of reluctant to talk about it because the king told him never to speak of it, and T'Challa does this whole angry, like, I am your king now. Everything goes back to that special flower garden. That's where they talk. So he tells him that N'Jabu was radicalized and that he saw the hardships of the world and saw it as basically his logic was that, like, oh, these people just don't have the tools to fight back, so they need Wakandan weapons to do it, and that these are our people, their people. There's a lot of push from one side of this that, like, it's the constant, there's a couple of different struggles that are going on here, and one is like, you know, globalization versus isolation, and like imperialism versus, I guess, not imperialism. So it's interesting because the stuff that N'Jabu talks about it'll be important later. This is where it's revealed that T'Chaka kills his brother and in defense of Zuri, and they left this is the other thing. He tells him that N'Jabu fell in love with an American woman and they had a son. And he tells him that they left the kid behind. And that this is a way to maintain the lie. And so, meanwhile, Michael B. Jordan's character, Killmonger, arrives and delivers Claw's body to the border tribe. So Ross, meanwhile, is perfectly, like, he's fine. He wakes up. He's like, how long have I been out? He's like, oh, that was, like, everything that happened was yesterday, and he's all healed up. It was really funny watching her calling him colonizer. That was really funny. Ross sees the trains, and we learned that, like, in order to how they transport the vibranium and everything and, like, the stabilizers that Shuri developed. Like, this is a multi-talented child. Meanwhile, Killmonger wants to liberate 2 billion people. He reveals his identity to the council, that he's the son of N'Jabu, and he's like, and it's funny the condescending way he calls Angela Bassett's character, hey auntie. That was just fun. That was just so funny. And he formally challenges T'Challa. So in the fight, Zuri is killed by Killmonger and calls him Uncle James, and T'Challa is also seemingly killed. He gets, like, thrown over the waterfall. Nakia, meanwhile, takes the Queen Mother and Shuri to safety. Okoye and Nakia then have a moment where Nakia tries to recruit Okoye to come and, like, join her and, like, going to wherever they're gonna go, because we don't know what's going on yet. And Okoye tells her that she's duty-bound to serve the king. And unfortunately, the king is Killmonger. So because she's Adora Milaje, this is her duty. Nakia then goes to get Ross. Meanwhile, Eric goes through, or Killmonger goes through the special ritual. And this is interesting because he also sees the flashback of his dad and all that jazz. And then he like sees and talks to his father. But what's interesting is that like for T'Challa, he sees the open savannah and the Black Panthers. Killmonger doesn't. He's back at that apartment from when he was a kid and he pulls out the book and he has like this moment of when his father first told him about Wakanda. But he's in that apartment with the background being that purplish like plane. Let's see. So he takes the herb and he's like, well, what are all these other ones doing here? Like, oh, these are in preparation for the next Black Panther. For the next king, he's like, well, I'm your king, and burn it all to the ground. I'm like, okay, like, obviously you're not going to be king for long, but like, wouldn't you want your descendants to also have this power now? All right, then.
Well, you find out more why it's being done. Because Everett Ross explains what he's doing.
Right, but still. So Nakia, meanwhile, steals one right before they all get burned to the ground. There's a question of, like, so they're in the like, I guess, meeting room. And they talk about, like, what the plan is, how they're going to give oppressed people all the world. Okay. So they're going to use the war dogs, who are the spies that Wakanda has all over the world. And they're going to give the weapons to give to the oppressed people all over the world to kill those in power and their children and anyone who sides with them. This is not going to solve anything, but okay. he says something that is actually very terrifying. He says, the sun will never set on the Wakandan Empire. Where have we heard that before? Michael, answer while I drink my water.
Oh, the Roman Empire? No. I don't know. Your history is better than mine right now.
The sun shall never set on the British Empire.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the British Empire legit controlled, like, one-third of the world at one point. So, like, this isn't actually about giving oppressed people the thing that they most need, which is freedom and dignity. This is more about establishing a Wakandan empire where everybody will allegedly be equal as long as everybody's under that umbrella of Wakanda. Because that always works out well. So it's Okoye and what's his name? He's the Wakabi are, I guess, a thing. They keep referring to each other as my love, so I guess they are.
Yeah. Yeah, they are, because I mean it comes up again later. It in does, the film.
Yeah. So let's see, where did I leave off? So meanwhile, Nakia and the Queen and Shuri and Ross, they go to M'Baku. And the Queen tells Nakia that she should be the one to take the herb. And she says, like, you know, she's a spy. She doesn't have an army. Like, she doesn't stand a chance. So they go to M'Baku, who they want him to do it. And M'Baku's like, this is a you problem. But he also, I like the fact, when they're talking to him and Ross tries to explain about Killmonger,
M'Baku starts barking at him.
Yeah, M'Baku stops him from speaking. He's like, if you speak another word, I will feed you to my children. And Ross has this look like, wait, what? And he's like, oh, don't worry, we're vegetarians. So Nakia offers him the herb because an outsider sits on the throne, and M'Baku takes them to another place within the like snowy mountain range where the Jabari tribe live. And we find out that T'Challa's alive. Like, I'm so shocked. Black Panther in a Black Panther movie's alive.
Well, he's alive, but he's barely alive.
Mostly dead is slightly alive. So he's only mostly dead. We're fine. So he is.
It's like a Mel Brooks bit here, you know?
Almost. It's The Princess Bride, so close enough.
Yeah.
Billy Crystal.
Well, not only that, but then you also had Monty Python, Holy Grail.
What was the one in the Holy Grail?
Jim Cleese's knight character. His Patsy got hit with an arrow. And it was like, oh, I don't think I'll make it through, sir. It's like, oh, no, I'm and like, he's like, oh, well, I will avenge you. It's like, no, you don't have to worry about it. I'm getting better. It's like, I will still avenge you for getting hit with the arrow. No, yeah. I think it's okay. I think I can make it through.
Or when what's his name? They fight that black, one of them fights that black knight.
Oh, the black knight.
And he, like, chops his arm off. Yeah, and he's like, it's just a flesh wound. I'm fine. And he's just, like, keeps kicking his butt.
Yeah, and then the other one was, like, they did it again later the next scene where he took out, like, everybody's, like it's his wedding party, and the idea was that he took out the other king, like, the father of the bride, and it's like, oh, no, he's getting better, and then, like, he just walks up, somebody stabs him, it's like, oh, well, he took a turn for the worst.
Yeah. Anyway, so T'Challa is slightly alive, and the queen actually, like, makes the herb into the liquidy format so that he can drink it, and he actually goes back to the ancestral plane, and T'Chaka's like, oh, my son, come join us, and T'Challa's kind of angry. He's like, why did you leave him behind? Like, you basically screwed up this kid. And we find out at some point, I think it was before this, that Eric Killmonger was, like, that's a nickname that he earned. He, like, joined the army or the SEALs, and he was, like, a mercenary, and he did all this stuff. And then he worked for the CIA as, like, a insurgent. Like
Black Ops. Yeah.
Black Ops that would, like, topple governments and all that jazz. So,
which is important because Rot Everett goes thoroughly into, like, as they're looking up who Killmonger is, Ross is going, like, oh, yeah, he's one of ours. He, you know, the burning of the flowers and, you know, dethroning of the king. You're like, he's trained to do this. This is what he's trained to do. So he's exactly going in, and he's tearing down an empire to build a new one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. So anyway, back in the ancestral plane, T'Challa basically tells his father and, like, all the previous kings that they were all wrong to keep the country in, like, pure isolation. And T'Challa says that, like, he knows the plan, and this is where Ross comes in and helps. Shuri has, she managed to take the suit before they left, and everyone vows to fight. And Ross is, like, totally on board. And then they have, then T'Challa goes to talk to M'Baku, and he's like, nope, this is your fight. The Jabari are staying put. And T'Challa's like, yeah, I can respect that. Can my mom stay here, please? Like, no harm will come to her. And I think, like, from, like, a political standpoint, there's an interesting moment where M'Baku's like, you are the first king in how many centuries to come up here? And hopefully that will indicate a, you know, more things to come and a positive relationship between Wakanda and the Jabari. So we find out that Wakabi and the others have contacted the War Dogs, and that London, New York, and Hong Kong are on board, but everybody else is a little iffy. It's like, okay, we'll start with those and then we'll work our way outward. It's fine. Killmonger's not too discouraged by that. So they have all of the planes with the weapons and they're ready to go. There's one helicopter is crashed right then and there, or, like, if they're not technically helicopters or planes, I don't know what to call them. One hovercraft, that's still not accurate, like, ship, we'll call them ships. So one of the ships is crashed, and Black Panther rises from the fire, and he tells Killmonger that he never yielded. So the fight's still on, which means the Doras are technically free to, like, technically, you know, that means T'Challa's still king. So,
yep.
So Shuri, Ross, and Nakia sneak into the lab. Wakabi gets the border tribe to take on Black Panther, and the Adora's betray Killmonger. Io goes to help the king. Io is actually very important to mention. In the Black Panther comics, she is, I believe it's Io that is gay in the comics. She's in a relationship with another woman of the Dora, of the Doras. I guess there was like a deleted scene or a planned deleted scene of like that's supposed to like talk about that or like had hinted at it or something. It was cut due to time or was, I don't even know. I don't know if it was filmed. I'll have to look at the deleted scenes for this later. But it's unfortunate that any of the scenes were cut. There's various reasons why scenes get cut. Sometimes it's because they don't fit in, they take away from the narrative of the story. Sometimes it's because China is a jerk that doesn't allow anything that is not straight in their content. We'll get back to that at a later time.
Well, not only that, but it's also like, as you're sitting down, you're watching the film as you're editing it. You're wanting a specific flow. And
no, like I said, it could be an issue of flow. It can be an issue of pacing. It can be an issue of like, oh, this takes away from the narrative.
Or you could be Warner Brothers and just go, no, we want you to cut it down for time.
There is also that. Yeah. So unfortunately, there's a lot of reasons why scenes get cut. And, you know, China's also one of them, potentially. So where did I leave off? Border skirmishes, the border tribe warriors fight the Doras, and it's real, like, first of all, the Dora Milaje should not be trifled with. Like, they managed to hold off Killmonger for a while, they take on the male warriors, they are incredible. It's also really cool that the border tribe, they're like these like shawls or wraps that they wear, like, actually have like, I think Claw tells Killmonger earlier, like right before they start trying to kill each other, that like they sew vibranium is in everything that Wakanda has. It's also in their clothes. And so here we see that the border tribe actually has like shields that come from these like wrap blank, like, I don't want to call them blankets, but these like
they're like shawls or something,
shawls, wraps, whatever you want to call it. So Ross will have to fly the plane, like the remote pilot the plane to take out the other planes that are carrying weapons that will basically launch World War III. And Shuri is even kind enough to put it in an American style so Ross can pilot it. Let's see. So the Doras do get knocked back. Nakia's manages to fight Killmonger for a while. But she's really no match for a guy high on leaf juice. Cactus juice? Avatar The Last Airbender's on Netflix. Go watch it. Shuri holds him back for a bit. So Shuri's like blasting him. And so her and Nakia are kind of tag teaming Killmonger. But he manages. He's stronger. So T'Challa gets knocked back by all of the border tribe warriors, but because his little sister's in trouble, he goes to save her. And then he and Killmonger fall into the catacombs, mines, whatever you want to call them.
Now, if I remember right, the Jabari came right before T'Challa went to fight Killmonger.
Maybe, or is because, that later?
Because the Jabari do show up.
They do indeed, yes. No, it's a little bit after this. So, okay. Let's see. It says, you won't see us become the same people as the ones you hate. Or basically, T'Challa tells Killmonger that what he's doing will just basically make him the bad guy. Like, you're gonna do the same thing to the people that like hate us, and you're gonna become them, basically. Killmonger kind of has like a one-track mind of like his vision is the only one that matters. And so Nakia gets slightly roughed up, but she's good. The Doras are cornered. The Doras get cornered by the border tribe. And this is when M'Baku shows up with the Jabari to help. Ross, the lab that Ross is in is getting shot at, but he doesn't care. He's still piloting, even though Sherry tells him to get out. At some point, the rhinos show up that we see being trained earlier by the border tribe. And we see Wakabi on a rhino heading towards Okoye, and the rhino just like stops right in front of her and licks her face. It's so cute.
And she starts petting its horn.
Yep.
And he's just like, "Damn it! I got betrayed by my own rhino."
I'm pretty sure it's her rhino now. So Killmonger and T'Challa fight. They end up using the trains and like the vibration to like it kind of has like a distortion effect. And it's a good distraction. So what happens is like throw the knife. I think like the knife that
Killmonger has
gets like thrown in the air, and then through the train is like a distraction, and it's still flying in the air, and then T'Challa catches it and stabs Killmonger with it
right in the heart.
And there's like this, they have kind of like a sweet moment of like watching the sunset, and he says, you know, T'Challa tells Killmonger like, oh, I can still save you maybe, and he says he won't be locked up. And then he just kind of kills himself.
Yeah, he pulls out the knife from his chest, which eventually ends up just being his own kill blow.
Tells him that death is better than bondage.
And he also asked to be
buried at sea
like his ancestors.
So everything kind of goes back to normal. T'Challa comes back as the king, and M'Baku is welcomed. We actually see T'Challa walking back into the throne room, and we see that M'Baku is actually in that room.
And I think he actually replaces Wakabi.
Yeah, that would make sense. So T'Challa thanks Nakia for like being there and helping out, and they kiss, and he like tries to convince her to stay, but she wants to fulfill her calling. So then we kind of go back to where this movie really started, which is in LA, in that building. And T'Challa and Shuri are standing in front of this building as kids are playing basketball again. And T'Challa tells her that he bought like all the like the
well,
like,
and the, I think Nakia was there too.
No, it's just Shuri and T'Challa. But he tells her, well, before this, he's with Nakia, and he says that he might have another way for Nakia to do what she wants to do while still being close. And so then he's with Shuri in
Oakland.
In Oakland, and he tells her that he bought several of these buildings, and that it's going to be the new Wakandan International Outreach Center, which I guess Nakia will run, and Shuri will be in charge of science and information or communication or whatever. And then the final scene is like the kids freaking out over the ship that gets the ship, and a kid walks over to T'Challa and asks like, "Hey, like, Mister, is this your spaceship?" And that's the end of the film itself. We have two after credit scenes, which is T'Challa addressing the United Nations and how he says, you know, he refuses to isolate Wakanda. And we flash to some white guy asking like, what is it that a nation of farmers can show us? Exactly. And that's where the scene ends. So we don't actually know what his comeback would have been to that. And finally, we see a bunch of kids who, I would guess by the fact that they're wearing like a red robe-ish thing, they're from the mining tribe, that they're kind of looking at someone, and then they like run out giggling. And Shuri's there, and she's like, "What are you doing? Are you playing with him and like teasing the man again? He needs his rest. And we see that it's Bucky. And he looks like he just woke up from a really nice nap. And she basically tells him like, "Hey, how are you doing?" And like, he thanks her and she's checking in on how he's doing. And then she tells him that he needs to come with her because he has much more to learn. And of course, this is the setup for everything that we will see in a little while. But there's something
starting at the very next movie.
Actually, no, because the very next movie is Infinity War.
Yeah, no, so it isn't Infinity War.
Yeah.
Yeah, so literally the next movie.
And one of the other things is that, for going back to this Bucky scene real quick, is that this is also kind of a precursor to his White Wolf character.
Very brief.
Because they refer to him as the White Wolf.
Right, but I don't think the White Wolf was actually Bucky.
Yeah, but it is, it's referenced though.
Yes, but in Marvel, the White Wolf is not actually Bucky. It's a completely separate character who is this is actually something, I'm glad you brought that up, because Killmonger is like a combination of like three different characters. Just like Thor Ragnarok was a combination of three different comics, Killmonger is a combination of three different villains. In this case, let's see here, Killmonger, let me see, I have this here. He is a combination of... let's see. Eric Killmonger is based on his version in the comics, a Wakandan exile who seeks to overthrow the country, but incorporates elements of T'Shawn, T'Challa's envious cousin, and the White Wolf, a relative of the Black Panther, who becomes a villainous extremist and wears a Black Panther-style habit. So he's a combination of three different characters. And we touched a little bit. There's something I want to add. One of my favorite characters was almost in this movie, and I need to point it out. His name is Eli Bradley, a.k.a. Patriot, a.k.a. the grandson of the Black Captain America, a.k.a. a child that needs more love. Marvel, come on! But he ended up being not in this movie mostly because I think he doesn't really have a place in this film as much as I love him, unless he's like one of those children playing basketball at the end of the film. Because Eli's origins are very based in US history. I hope he shows up in a sequel somehow. I don't really care how. So that would be cool to see. But the other thing is like Marvel is eventually setting up a Young Avengers thing. So maybe that's why he was not in this film. Okay. So let's talk about this movie. As I mentioned before, there was a lot of detail, there was a consultant that was brought on. Even the composer, whose name is Ludwig Göransson, I probably butchered that. He actually traveled, he's the composer for the film, so he wrote the music. He traveled to South Africa. He visited the International Library of African Music. He listened to the musical archives of thousands of different tribes in Africa. He also went to Senegal and recorded local musicians, which helped to form the base for the music of this film, which I think is incredible. And this movie is also unique in the fact that it actually surpassed its initial budget. So in its opening weekend, it made more money than it actually cost to make the film. I think like $2 million over, which is amazing. Remember how when we were doing phase one, we talked a little bit about how a lot of these films were planned from like way back when in the 90s. And this is no exception because Wesley Snipes almost ended up being Black Panther. But there was a number of issues. The technology hadn't been good enough to really catch up to the idea, as we learn as these movies continue.
It took 20 years to finally get a Black Panther movie.
It really did, though. Wesley Snipes, of course, went on to play Blade, and there was a lot of contention between what Wesley Snipes wanted versus what the studio wanted versus what the director wanted. There's a note here on the IMDb page that says, given the limitations and special effects at the time, Black Panther's suit would basically be a leotard with cat ears. John Singleton was briefly considered as director, but this never materialized as Snipes insisted on keeping the story situated in Africa, while Singleton wanted to place the character in America during the Civil Rights Movement. Another obstacle proved to be the fact that the name Black Panther was mainly associated with the Black Panther group from the 60s and 70s. So, or the 70s. I think it was mostly the 70s and then into the 80s, I believe.
I know they had prominence during like the Vietnam War and stuff like
that. So late 60s and into the 70s, yeah. Funny enough, Black Panther as a character was created like 2 months before everybody learned about the existence of the Black Panther movement, which is kind of ironic. So it's kind of a question of who took the name from who. I believe Black Panther, the character, was actually first, and then they briefly changed him to be the Black Leopard or something, which was just doesn't fit. This movie has, but anyway, he is Black Panther. I love the spirituality in this movie. We see a lot of mentions of Bast. And I hope maybe we'll see Bast actually show up. We sort of see her in the Panthers that we see in the Ancestral Plane. But in the comics, there is a particular moment in the Black when she actually has a more active role in Black Panther's wedding. So in the comics, Black Panther marries Storm, who is technically the Queen of Kenya, but is also, you know, a mutant and a powerful hero. And so they get married, but they can't just get married. It's not just like, okay, you have a ceremony, that's it. They actually have to go into this like ancestral plane, and the goddess Bast actually has to decide if like the woman that T'Challa has chosen is worthy. This is like, you know, you're getting judged by a goddess. That's kind of scary. It all ends up fine. Their marriage doesn't end up fine, but this moment ends up fine. So I liked that idea. I liked it. Like I said, I really liked the spirituality of the movie and how they did it. It was really well done. I like this like different struggle that we see of ideologies, this isolationism versus intervention, and like the question of colonialism and imperialism, more imperialism than colonialism, of what is being done by different antagonists. So that was very well done. I have one more note in here that I absolutely loved. It has to do with Martin Freeman's son. Let's see here.
Well, while you're looking that up real quick, there's an interesting little tidbit in here as well when it comes to the actors. So the person who plays young Zuri, his name is Denzel Whitaker. However, he is not related at all to Forrest Whitaker. And in a movie before Black Panther, Forrest Whitaker actually plays his father in the film.
That's hilarious. But to go off of that, it should be noted that the actor who plays T'Chaka, really quickly, his son actually plays a younger version of him, which is really cool. I think it was John Connie's son who played the younger version of King T'Chaka, which was really cool. Speaking of sons, because I like to segue with style, Martin Freeman actually introduced his son to co-star Danai Gurira, who plays Okoye. And apparently she was his son's favorite character in the film. And according to her, he was so excited and like entranced by her, by like the ability to meet her and be with her, that like he wouldn't like go of her hand. And she was like really touched by how the film could like completely capture someone's imagination. And that to me is just like so sweet and tells you how relatable this movie is. And it should also be noted, since we are in a very, very complex time and a very difficult time, the writer, comic book writer Jonathan Mayberry, who is very well known, he wrote the Doom War arc. He also ended up working on Black Panther, but he first learned about apartheid as a young teen because of the Black Panther's appearance in the Fantastic Four issue 119. this actually encouraged him to break away from the upbringing of his father, who was an actual member of the KKK in Philadelphia. And funny enough, the editors at Marvel didn't know this at the time when he ended up taking on the job of writing the Black Panther comic. And he often cites the Black Panther as one of the most significant positive influences of his life. So if you don't understand the kind of impact that Black Panther can make, like, you just learned, like, that is insane. That is amazing. I'm probably going to sneeze in about 30 seconds.
So while you try to sneeze in 30 seconds, I'll throw this out there. One scene that I actually really liked, and you kind of just glossed over it a little bit, was back at the casino. And that was when Ross and Everett were doing their exchange. Because you have Ross with this nice briefcase, they're showing off the diamonds. And Ulysses Klo just kind of takes the vibranium and just kind of just chucks it on the table in a brown paper bag. Yeah. Like it was his lunch. And Ross is like, that's how you're going to bring it? It's like, yeah, man, we don't have to go special for this thing. It's like, it's just so interesting. No,
he tells them that, like, oh, I was going to invest in a fancy suitcase, but then I thought I'd save myself the money.
Yeah. And but it's still funny, though, when you look at it. It's like, it's a serious exchange that then gets turned into a joke because, like, yeah, nah, I just wanted to put it in a lunch bag, essentially.
Yeah.
So, are you ready for that time?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think we've touched on everything. I think, you know, Killmonger is there's a lot of things that were established. I think there's not quite as many hints as to what could happen in a sequel, but there's a lot of avenues for them to pursue. I hope we get to see the Dora Milaje do more. They got to do plenty, but, like, we only really got to know Okoye in this film, and she's still the only Dora Milaje that we really know. Hopefully future sequels will give us more about them. We definitely need to get to know Io more. And, you know, I think we just need to see more. I think they did a great job of establishing this world, and I hope we continue to see what they make of it, and I hope that it's good.
Well, especially the fact that we're going to be seeing it heavily going into the next film.
Exactly. So with that, tell us how this movie did.
So, Black Panther clocked in at 2 hours and 14 minutes. And as you remember, last week when we talked about Thor Ragnarok, not Dark World, it clocked in at a 7.9 out of 10 with the IMDb score. That's what Ragnarok got. Black Panther got a 7.3 out of 10.
I'm sorry.
But I know you're going to jump in and go, oh, I'm sorry, but it's a much better movie, blah, blah. You're right. However, and we will talk about this because I know eventually we're going to talk about the DC universe and, like, talk about Wonder Woman. This film got the exact same treatment that Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel got, which was harsh treatment because people couldn't handle a black lead superhero, just like how with Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel, they didn't like the fact that it was a female superhero as the lead. Because yes,
So I mean I don't like the Captain Marvel movie all that much. I will say I loved Wonder Woman and I love this movie. I think the best part of this movie was seeing a theater full of people with so many children, and obviously I think this movie, you know, it brought a lot of conversation to the surface, and it shows that, first of all, you should be making more movies with other people other than, you know, white Anglo-Saxon people. Like, this world has so many other people in it. Say the two Jews whose representation in popular media is
But one thing I want to throw on this too is that, and this is kind of a downer thing, and I don't want to end this on a downer, but it's actually true. I really wish my friend Mansa got to see this movie because he passed away a month before the film came out.
Oh.
And I remember how excited Mansa was for this film, because we were talking about wanting to see it together and stuff like that. And then he passed away literally the week after his birthday.
Oh, gosh. I'm so sorry. And
so it's like, that's the one regret that I do have about this film, is the fact that Mansa never got to see it. Because I remember when he would see the trailers and stuff, and just in conversation with him, he was just so proud of what he was seeing. And, you know, and it's just a shame I couldn't have that conversation with him, going like, yo, what do you think about Black Panther and stuff like that? And it sucks, but it's such a great movie though. And I know if he was here, he would be damn proud about this movie.
And I will say this right now, because I didn't get to say it earlier. This movie is better than Ragnarok. It is!
And here's the thing. I think the 7.3 score is simply because, you know, it's just because people couldn't handle the fact that it was a essentially like a Black Pride film. That's because that's how a lot of people viewed it. And, you know, the people who, and we're seeing it now in real life with everything going on, you know, with all the white supremacists and stuff. That's who flooded the Rotten Tomatoes and stuff to give it a bad score right away, because they didn't like the fact that this is a, you know, this huge movie. And it's like, I'm glad it did well, and it was a great movie to watch, and I can't wait to see the sequel.
I will say this movie is not without some issues, just like any movie. Once again, we kill off a bad guy that we could have used.
Well, Killmonger, they always say that Killmonger could come back, because he does come back in the comics, even after he's killed.
No one stays dead in comics except Uncle Ben and Batman's parents. This is a rule. But I guess if King T'Chaka can come back within the ancestral plane, we can get anybody back. But I would have loved to see just a little bit more of the culture, because we got to see the tribes at the coronation, but we didn't really get to see how the society functions. What does each tribe do? We got a little bit of that. We got to see what the border tribe does. We didn't get to see what the other tribes do as much. It would have been cool to see kind of how Wakanda's, just a little bit, like, we got so much culture and so much beauty, but it would have been nice to see some of the sociological aspects of the country. Like, what do people do for jobs? What does school look like? Like those sorts of things. I always want that kind of stuff, just because it's watching people live in a world like this is just so fascinating.
Yeah, and that coronation where they're going down the river, and then you just see all the people up, and like just the colors of what the people are wearing, and the singing and the chanting and the dancing. It is such a beautiful visual.
It really is. And I know people like to harp a lot on Marvel and criticize it. And there are certainly things to criticize, just like with any franchise and anything really. But you gotta hand it to them that the director and everybody involved in this movie cared so, so much about not only telling a good story when it came to a character like Black Panther, but showing us an amazing culture, an amazing country, and not trying to turn it into like some kind of like European style country in Africa. Everything is very much in tune with Africa. And like, there's so much, like, there's just a large effort to ground Wakanda within Africa. And they did an amazing job with incorporating different styles of different nations and different tribes. And it's awesome. I really enjoy rewatching the movie. The jokes are still really good. The visuals are still so much fun to watch. And I'm excited for the sequel.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the sequel.
2022.
Oh, only 2 years to go.
Yeah, maybe the apocalypse won't happen so we can actually see it.
When's the apocalypse coming this time?
I don't know. What month are we in? June.
Fair.
So we're in the sixth stage of Jumanji.
I think if we can make it to 2021, we'll be safe. So fingers crossed here, folks.
And whoever's playing the board game Jumanji, please finish the damn board game already.
Yeah,
I think seriously. We've had enough of this crap.
This is getting out of hand here, folks.
Yeah. Finish your Jumanji game already. But so with that, Sasha, where can the people find you on the social medias?
Geekgirl101.tumblr.com. I always like getting questions about things I have not answered before. Like, no, seriously. I've gotten like 5 asks in a row on my Tumblr of things that I've probably answered like 5 different times already. And of course, Geeky Captain on Instagram. You can see wonderful pictures of my very snooty cat.
All right. And you can follow me on Twitter at @thelindabomb75, Facebook at facebook.com/x75productions. And as always, txhchockey.com, and for the show, /nerdy-notions. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls.
With that, thank you so much for joining us. And please come back next time as our -63 listeners will get the wonderful pleasure of hearing us talk about Thanos and Infinity War.